We continue now with Anne Waldman, the internationally known poet, teacher, editor, and co-founder of the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. That's at Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. Her latest book is Vow to Poetry, Essays, Interviews, and Manifestos. It's an invaluable guide to anyone seeking the cutting edge in the intersection of poetry and activism. Well, you know, before we go any further, you have not read anything. So maybe something from Marriage, a Sentence. You know I like Darko Night. I don't know if you have that one tagged, but that's a beautiful, playful one with
Sure, I'd love to read that. Okay, Dark of Night. This is from Marriage, a Sentence. In some places, a woman would marry a woman, which torques the definition of marriage. Would it be so simple, any such definition? For they throw stones at you in the torqued definition of marriage. It hurts to be unkind, they say, and cast a stone. Or someone had a man take a slug at her on an emotional national holiday because she was a known lover of women who had a wife. And it was a man's holiday, a memorial day for dead warriors who were mostly especially in the two wars men. Or maybe she, the woman slugged, was a wife. This is a two wives' tale. It was unseemly to see two women kissing, two women embrace under the primrose tree, two women in a Lautrec brothel holding the tide together against the slings of men, caressing against the tide of pimps and other men. Some get murderous in Oregon to see the women, too, shopping together as might a man and wife, living as do a man and wife in an ordinary man and wife apartment, doing man and wife things. Except at night, in the deep dark of night, they said, they who were murderous and dark. What do they do at night? While we are doing our man and wife things, what do they do in the dark of night? What do they do?
What do they do? That's the question. Absolutely. You know, to make a vow of poetry.
Just say no to family values.
Your bumper sticker. Tell us what it means to make a vow of poetry, besides an exciting life filled with few financial rewards, misery, and in some countries, death.
Well, I talk a little bit about that in the introduction, giving a kind of definition of vow coming from the Middle English V-O-W-E, which is from vous, V-O-U, from Old French, from the Latin votum or vote. So this was a real nugget here, this sense of voting coming from the neuter past participle of vovere, to vow. Also to be enjoyed, the playful association with vowel from Middle English, vowel from Old French, vowel from Latin vocalis, sounding from vox or vocus, voice. So by my own skewed associational mathematics, vow equals voice. And, and I say I vote always for the transforming of language's energies or languages, energies, sides with a full voice. So this sense of vocalizing the text, the actual, the creative texts, which often come to me in this sort of oral way. I mean, I'll hear them before I sometimes see them. And then the sense of being, vocal with what's going on and what I see and what I witness, being a kind of witness. And I think that word plays in here as well. So this sense of being empowered, of course, we feel disempowered if the votes aren't counted properly, and we feel disempowered going to, endless war without really knowing what that means, and so on. So I, this also carries the spiritual sense that you have in the Buddhist tradition, particularly the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, which is, some of the underpinning of the whole Naropa project, to create a school that was non-competitive and really work with Sangha, which is the Sanskrit word for community. But the vow there, the Bodhisattva vow, is that, you will be a bridge, you will be a cloak to You will be a meal for the hungry. You will benefit others before you benefit yourself. So you want to create things that actually benefit others down the line. So I've been on this more lately. Maybe I feel, you know, time gets more precious, but we're trying to save, for example, our tape archive at the Naropa University. We have, you know, nearly 30 years of incredible oral moments, the things that you are not going to get on text, spontaneous performances, collaborative work with jazz musicians and others. We have you know, Ginsberg, you know, composing on the spot. We have classes and lectures and colloquia with, you know, interactions between people, people thinking on their feet and also vocalizing their minds. This is, you know, often in a class you are reading, yes, a poem by William Blake or Whitman, but it's done in a particular way, which is real transmission. So this sense of transmission, you know, the vow to the voice, to the voting, to the vocalization of text, to transmission that you're not going to get in the same way.
Yeah.
So the Bodhisattva vow is really to, you know, benefit and leave, you know, support and create environments for others to continue and to follow the path of least suffering. So I'd say that's the, you know, the idea that there's always the conflict between, you know, making art and having it under your, you know, your name and owning it, and then what is not to own it, what is to let it go, or to feel that you're part of a continuum. I mean, I very much feel I'm a part of a continuum of people who work with words, and there's a whole, you know, extraordinarily glorious history before me, and there's incredible stuff coming, you know, now and after, and it's magnificent and strong, and it's an alternative to you know, this, you know, media speak and degraded language and the lies, the incredible, you know, lies every day, these sort of opportunistic realities that are so detrimental to, you know, the language, not to mention all the languages in our world that are going, you know, going extinct, right, from other cultures.
Right.
And animals too, in, yeah, the language and song of animals.
So that sense of lineage was illuminated for you in part by Charles Olson at the Berkeley Poetry Conference in 1965.
I would say definitely, because he was a figure then, certainly Ginsberg as well, and others who were participating in that convocation, which was, you know, major. It was one of the first gatherings outside of a more academic situation that brought together the lineages of the New American Poetry. And of course, the lineages of the New American Poetry were coming out of a lot of the work of the modernists, certainly Pound and Williams and Stein and H.D. and others. And it was a kind of, you know, statement. And going there at the age of 20 was, again, like a transmission, and actually hearing poetry in this way and seeing it being presented by, you know, weird, exciting, lumbering people who were not in a, you couldn't, they were out of a mold. I mean, outside the mold of the more academic poetries of the time, and the presentation too. I mean, that kind of, again, very narrative, subject-oriented, neat, often tormented, but I, you know, I'm there's a lot that can blossom and bloom. I'm not a, you know, fixed in one particular school by any means, and I loved hearing Robert Lowell read when I was in high school. I mean, there was a unusual event, and there's something about that raw, you know, voice, personage up there without a lot of props and without a lot of, you know, lighting and makeup and preconceived, scripted performance, because so much of our world is scripted, as you know, and that, you know, in terms of media, it's just horribly scripted. I guess sports is the only thing that still has a, you know, a some suspense and surprise, but, you know, from the news to these kinds of, you know, shows and talking, and so there's something very unscripted about the
The reading.
The reading.
And authentic, too.
Yep.